Welcome to the Sci-Fi Show, where we talk science and philosophy with two of my favourite atheist philosophers, Alex Malpass and Dan Linford. How are you doing, guys? Alex, what are you drinking? I know you've already started drinking.
I am drinking kind of this Burnt Mill Brewery Silver Falls IPA, which is delicious, actually.
So, yeah. Right. Dan, what are you on?
I'm just drinking water. It's 2 o'clock in the afternoon here in the States, so...
Right, I'm on antibiotics actually. I had a bit of an infection on my tooth, so no. So it's just Alex. We might be joined by someone else actually, because my cat Erebus is asleep right next to me. So if he wakes up and starts talking, you'll know why. Look, but today we're going to be examining the arguments of the Christian apologist John Lennox. Lennox is a professor of mathematics at Oxford University, but if you are expecting seriously sophisticated arguments, prepared to be disappointed. Is that fair, do you think, Alex?
Yeah, I do think so in this case. This is we're sort of alternating between funny episode and serious episode, and we're on a fun one now. He's not great, to be fair. He's really quite bad at apologetics. And actually a little bit triggering for me, because he, when listening to him, he reminds me of an ex-partner's dad that I used to have to deal with quite a lot, who was also a vicar. Let's just say that. I don't want to be too personal about it, but he was the type of person who would tell very similar sounding anecdotes to Lennox, and type of thing where you have to just sit there and listen to these stories that go on for ages, and there's no interjection or doing anything with it. You just have to go, okay, yeah. So quite painful. That's why I've started drinking already. I'm like, it's gonna be fine. It's just like therapy.
All right, you'll be okay. You'll be okay. Dan, any thoughts on Lennox before we play the first clip?
So I do have to say that, you know, even though I disagree with the content what he says, and I don't think that there's a whole tremendous amount to what he says, I do find his voice enjoyable to listen to. So if he did like books on tape or something, I would probably find that enjoyable. He seems like a personable guy. So I'm sure there are situations in which interacting with him would be pleasant.
Right, but not when he's doing apologetics, perhaps.
Yeah, that's right.
Right, so this first clip is of Lennox with some of the key players in the intelligent design movement, and it's hosted by the right-wing think tank, the Hoover Institute. So let's see what he's got to say about evolution.
We don't seem to have descended from apes. Or at least if we did, it ain't in the fossil record. What does that tell us?
Here's where Darwin helped me massively, by expressing in a letter a profound doubt. He said, you know, and I'm only paraphrasing because I haven't got the quote in my head. He said, you know, I'm troubled by the fact that if my explanation is correct, then how do we account for the human capacity for rational thought? He said, after all, if we started with lower animals and a monkey's mind, he said, well, is there any thinking in a monkey's mind? Now, hold that just for a moment, because I have lots of fun with my scientific friends. I sometimes ask them, what do you do science with? And of course, they name some expensive machine. I say, no. Oh, they say, you mean you're, and they're about to say mind when they realize that's not politically correct. And I smile at them and I say, and you trust it? I say, now tell me honestly, that computer you use every day, if you knew that it was the end product of a mindless, unguided process, would you trust it? Now, here's the thing. I have spoken with dozens of leading scientists and pushed them on this, and every single one has said no.
What planet is he on that mind is a politically incorrect word? What? But Alex, this sounds a bit like planting his argument, C.S. Lewis type of argument.
Yeah. What's going on? I mean, you'll note that he doesn't actually make an argument. We have to interpret what he's saying to be, he's sort of gesturing towards an argument. So there are a couple of things that were quite triggering about this for me. Like the just saying that Darwin, you know, why does he bring up Darwin's doubt here? I mean, he doesn't give a citation, so I don't know what Darwin is supposed to have actually said here. But it seems to me that what he's doing is he's thinking, oh, atheists love Darwin, so if I can get them with what Darwin said, then that's going to be really good. And that's just basically, like, to call it a fallacy of appeal to authority makes it seem like what he said was an argument, or he's trying to, but it wasn't really. But I think that's what he was trying to do. He's just trying to wheel out the big dog and just quote something from Darwin, right? But if you think about what Darwin just says there, is like, well, if we evolved from apes, and is there any thinking in an ape or something, is what he says. Right?
But, are there any thoughts in a monkey's mind? Like,
yeah, and when the answer is, well, yes, obviously. So, I mean, what happens if you don't say yes to that question? I don't understand. And like, anyway, so I guess his idea is that like the answer is supposed to be obviously no, and that that means it's a big step jump, and that that's the thing that's not explainable. And I just find that whole idea that that's what Darwin thought to be very strange, because isn't the whole point of Darwin? He's talking about slow, gradual changes over time, right? But for some reason, he thinks there has to be one big, massive change when it comes to rationality. Now, I don't know if he even said that, because there's no citations. I don't know what I'm supposed to look up to check that, but just sounds, it sounds wrong. It's incredibly weak anyway. Like, maybe Darwin just said something silly, but like, just think it through. What if, you know, it's like when you're playing a chess game and you have to plan against what the best move the opponent makes. And it's like, he's going, I'm going to play this, and then you're going to play this rubbish move, and that means I'm going to win. What if you don't play the rubbish move, right? It's just, it's really low tier stuff. And then just really quickly, the other thing that really triggered me about this was, he then goes off into this sort of fantasy about like having a conversation with someone. He doesn't name anyone in particular or a date or anything like that. So he just says, I have this conversation with all of my scientist friends. Like, he's got all these scientist friends. And what, does he have the same conversation with all of them? You know, the thing about this is, like, even if I found someone who had a conversation with him and they said, well, that's not how the conversation went, that wouldn't really be disproving it, because he didn't name anyone in particular. So there's no, it's completely unfalsifiable. It's, he is just making up something. It's bullshit, isn't it? I mean, we know that he didn't have this actual conversation. I guess he's doing it for rhetorical effect. But what happens in the story is he poses a question, and all of the scientists are like, oh, no, you've got me. You're right about that, actually. God, you're so clever. And that's basically the point of his story. It's so annoying. Anyway, I'm not saying anything with much philosophical content, but it's difficult, because that's one of the things that really, really gets me annoyed listening to this guy. He's just making stuff up. It's just a story. So anyway, but Dan will have something more concrete to say.
Yeah,
about
Dan,
what's
did
wrong.
He get evolution right there? He said we evolved from monkeys. Did we evolve from monkeys?
Well, so the way that I understand it is that the monkeys are more basal to the primates. So there's this traditional answer that evolutionists are supposedly supposed to give, which is that we did not evolve from monkeys, that these are two different distinct groups of primates. But in there's a way of understanding the hierarchy of organisms called cladistics, and in cladistics, clade is all of a group of organisms together with all of their descendants. So, for instance, viewers might have heard that there's no such thing as a fish, and the reason why there's no such thing as a fish is because there's no such thing as the fish clade. I mean, there is a culinary category, which is fish, but since all land animals, for instance, evolved from, I guess with the exception of maybe insects or something, but, you know, mammals, reptiles, birds, etc., all evolved from fish, if you want to say that there is a fish clade, then we would be fish. Likewise, my understanding of the way that the taxonomy of the apes and monkeys and so on works, I believe I got this from watching a Guts of Gibbon video, is that the monkeys are basal, and so all apes are monkeys, and so we did evolve from monkeys, but we didn't evolve from any of the monkeys that are around today. That's an important point to make. One of the things that Alex's comments brings out to me that I think is really peculiar about the history is that, you know, I didn't look into whether Darwin in fact said this, but if he did say it, one of the things that's really strange to me about that is that already in the 18th century, you find people wondering about what the boundary is between non-human primates and human beings. So, for instance, Julien Lefray-Lemaître, who was a French materialist and surgeon, wonders whether if you took one of the other apes and raised them as you would a human child, if they would act just as a civilized, you know, civilized in quotations, all the connotations that means for someone in the 18th century, if they would then act like a civilized person, if you could then, you know, like present them in Paris or something. And so by the time you get to the 19th century, I would have thought that the general understanding people would have would be that there isn't this giant gulf that separates human beings from other animals. It's also peculiar because I think, you know, even non-primates have thoughts. When my cat looks into her bowl and it's empty, she has the thought, my bowl is empty. Not in that sentence, but she has the content of that thought in her mind.
My cat makes me very, very, very aware first thing in the morning.
Yeah. So I think the other thing that's really peculiar about these kinds of Plantinian or Lewisian kind of arguments is that they imagine that, you know, part of what has to be behind this argument is this thought that discovering mind-independent truths about the natural world, like we do in science, is somehow fundamentally different from the traits that evolution selected for in other animals, like avoiding predators and so on. And so the suggestion would be that the cognitive capacities we use when we do science are unrelated to those most likely shaped by evolution. And as far as I can tell, this is just seems to me totally wrong. I have a friend of mine, Carl Sachs, who is a philosopher that's worked a lot on the evolution of human cognition. Maybe we'll have him on the program sometime in the future. I was talking to him about this issue, and the point that he brought out to me was that, so it's true on the one hand that science as it presently is doesn't just use the cognitive capacities that we get naturally from evolution. It'd be really surprising if that's the way that it worked. However, science historically originates from those same cognitive capacities and then goes beyond them. How does that happen? Well, through collaboration and community-wide practice, we transcend our evolutionary limits. We also receive feedback from the world that often corrects our intuitions about things that are far removed from everyday life. So at the same time, this does give us reason to be skeptical about our ability to do to investigate metaphysical matters from the armchair. So importantly, science, unlike armchair metaphysics, is not beholden to the kind of cognitive abilities that any of us innately possess. Science takes feedback from the external world and then uses that feedback to make revisions, right? I mean, if you've ever worked in the sciences, as I have, then you would be familiar with the experience that whatever you might intuitively think is going on in whatever system you're working on is typically not what's going on in there. And when you do experiments, you find something really surprising, and it takes a long time to come to some hypothesis that really explains what you're seeing in your data. But that, of course, is just not what you can do with your innate cognitive abilities from the armchair. You need that feedback from the world to constantly make revisions. You need feedback from a community of inquirers to constantly make revisions. And that allows you to go well beyond the cognitive capacities that you would have had had you never lived in a community, had you never had language, had you never gone out and done experiments.
So one thing I thought was interesting is that he said, his scientist friends would say, they wouldn't trust it. They wouldn't trust that computer if it was part of an unguided process. It wasn't clear to me whether he meant the computer in your head or one on your laptop. But if it's the one in your head, I think most scientists accept evolution that is unguided. So they wouldn't say that. I don't believe that. If they meant the one on this laptop or something, well, they don't go through an evolutionary process. They don't reproduce themselves. There's nothing like that. So it's just irrelevant, you know. The other thing is, what does he mean by, reliable processes? Because there's more than 100 cognitive biases in human psychology. So that seems to me unreliable, you know. But what does it mean, reliable?
Like, so I think I think we need to be careful when we take that kind of line. So, right, you are right that there are going to be places where our innate cognitive abilities are unreliable. And that's something I brought out, for instance, what I was saying. But it needs to be reliable enough to get the project off the ground in the first place, right? Like, I'm sitting at a desk right now and I'm looking at it, and I don't think that I'm hallucinating. And so that's my ordinary experience of the world that I'm not hallucinating. And so there's these kinds of like really run-of-the-mill cognitive processes that are fairly reliable. But it's when we turn to things that are far afield from our everyday experience that our cognitive processes start to become extremely unreliable. That's when it becomes useful to do things like do experiments. And that makes complete sense if you buy into the evolutionary picture, right? Because on the evolutionary picture, it's going to be that having a general liability of your cognitive faculties in ordinary circumstances is useful for survival. It's useful for avoiding predators and so on. And then it's going to be in these more exotic cases where our innate cognitive abilities begin to fail us, and where we need to do something else, something that takes us beyond those innate abilities. If Plantinga's argument was just that if something like, you know, if naturalism and evolution were true, then we couldn't do a certain kind of like speculative armchair metaphysics, well, that's exactly right. I think that that's just as true, right? And that's why I don't think that we have reliable access to those kinds of metaphysical issues. And it's why I think like doing a certain kind of theology like these folks want to do is not something that is going to get us someplace very useful.
All right, so let's go to the next clips here. There's sort of two clips about the relationship between science and religion.
As we look at the rise of science in the 16th and 17th centuries, Alfred North Whitehead and many others commented that men became scientific because they expected law in nature, and they expected law in nature because they believed in the lawgiver. So, ladies and gentlemen, I'm not ashamed of being both a scientist and a Christian, because arguably Christianity gave me my subject. What I am amazed at is that serious thinkers today continue to ask us to choose between God and science. That's like asking people to choose between Henry Ford and engineering as an explanation of the motor car.
So, Alex, you want to start us off on this? Like, should we thank Christianity for science? Is that right?
I mean, it's just a completely vague general hypothesis. It doesn't really mean anything. Like, he speculates wildly, it seems to me. Maybe Whitehead was also speculating wildly too. It's another name drop within no citation, so there's not really anything you can do with that. But I've heard this a lot, right? That you hear this in, actually you hear this same line, interestingly, in like white nationalists as well, who talk about how rationality came out of Europe and we owe everything to the white Enlightenment thinkers or whatever, as if you couldn't have arrived any other way than the way that it happened to go. So there's some. It's contingently true that the Enlightenment predominantly, you know, was a European thing, well, not entirely European, but. And obviously it was a Christian continent. So like the two things contingently were together at the same time. And of course, loads of scientists were Christians. You know, Newton was at least a deist. He wasn't an atheist anyway. But like drawing a causal connection between them and saying, you know, that we've got this one because of that one, it's actually post hoc ergo proctor hoc, right? That's the... after this, therefore, because of this kind of thing, right? So it seems wildly unformed or whatever. There's nothing really concrete about it. But it also seems to me like if we're speculating completely randomly about it, then you could say that if there's some kind of supernatural agent that's in charge of everything, whose powers can transcend any of the laws that they instigate, that's some reason to not expect the world to be law-like, because they could just intervene and change the laws or make a miracle happen that you couldn't possibly predict, that doesn't obey any law-like regularities or whatever. So it's not really even clear to me that it's a helpful hypothesis to suppose there's some like special magic man that can control everything. That undermines it. That when they were doing science, they were, you know, and they, I'm adopting his language, right? It's like it's insidious, but they, when the scientists were talking about it, they were basically putting God to one side and then thinking about the world as a big mechanism and like a clock or whatever, and trying to work out how all the parts were fiddled together and stuff. And they didn't suppose that there was somebody getting in the way. So it's basically just the same as it would have been if it was just law-like regularities with no one behind it. I mean, I just don't understand how it, like, you couldn't have come to that way of thinking about things unless you thought there was some agent that authored those laws. I just don't understand it. So it could be true. It's big speculation, unverifiable. And it seems to me that there's another hypothesis. It could also be true. And we'll probably just never know because we're not even stating any terms clearly enough to settle the question, right?
I mean, Dan, I was thinking people were doing science in ancient Greece, weren't they? I mean, look, you had the people, the scientists in Milates around sort of 600 BC, like Anaximander, they came up with naturalistic hypotheses for stuff. So that's like one part of the scientific process. Then you have people like Pythagoras who come up with mathematical sort of representations of the world. That's another step, you know, including mathematics. You had Eratosthenes doing experiments, and they actually correctly measured the circumference of the Earth by doing an experiment. I mean, am I on the right track here, Dan?
So I have a friend of mine, Elizabeth Jelinek, who studies ancient Greek science, and Plato in particular. Maybe we'll have her on the program in the future or something. But she's argued that you can find the notion of laws of nature in Plato. You know, I'm not an expert in ancient Greek science or in the history of science outside of the Western world. I do remember that back when I was in graduate school, I took a course on the history of laws and causes. And there was a historical issue that we looked at in that course, which was something like the following. So if my friend is wrong about there being laws in Plato, for example, the usual story about where laws first appear is in the early modern period. And it is with the divine command theory of those laws, that the reason you see these laws is because of this kind of Cartesian picture that God commands that nature does certain kinds of things. You then have that the laws are metaphysically contingent because God's commands are metaphysically contingent, but they also have a certain kind of necessity because everything has to do as God commands it to do. And so that gives you this kind of necessity and also this kind of metaphysical contingency that people even today want to say holds true about laws. It's a standard philosophical view about how laws are supposed to work. But outside of the Western world, you also see advances in science in Asia, particularly in China, for example. And there's this historical puzzle that apparently has that historians and philosophers have worked on for a long time about why it was that the notion of laws of nature apparently doesn't arise in China. So even though Chinese science becomes really advanced, you don't see this idea about laws of nature being introduced, apparently, according to the historians that we read for the course. And the explanation that I've seen floated for why that might be is because the early modern science in the West was done in a particular kind of theological context. And so maybe that's the kind of idea that Lennox is drawing upon. But anyway, I'm not sure, on the one hand, what it means to choose between science and religion. And I'm also not sure why the fact that it arose out of theology is supposed to show us anything important. The fact of the matter is, while scientists, or natural philosophers as they were once called, once invoked theology, in particular Christian theology, to develop testable hypotheses, they no longer do so. And there's important reasons why they no longer do so. So, for instance, in the 17th century, Noah's flood was a common geological explanation. By the time you get to the 1830s, however, things had changed altogether. So there's this guy named Adam Sedgwick, who was a geologist and an Anglican priest. He fought, alongside many other people, for the view that we should base geological hypotheses upon the Bible. And eventually came to realize that that approach was deeply flawed. And in 1831, he publicly recanted that view, publicly recanted what was called flood geology in a speech given to the Geological Society. Philip Kitcher has called the event a funeral oration. Now, similar stories appear in physics, astronomy, biology, archaeology, in all these different sciences. You can find some historical period when people thought that they could draw hypotheses directly from the Bible or from other theological sources. And they thought that that was a good way of doing science. It was a mainstream way of doing science. However, they came to realize that that was a bad way of developing hypotheses. And to me, it seems like we can draw kind of inductive inference, a kind of inductive generalization over this history of widespread failure of theological scientific projects, right? We've learned that that's a bad way of doing science. Now, everyone today, just about everyone, all practicing scientists basically agree that that's a bad way of doing science. I think the best explanation of the fact that that turned out to be a bad way of doing science is that we don't live in a world where there's a where a good theological explanation can be posited for the world. Theological scientific research programs universally degenerate and have universally degenerated in the past because we just don't live in the kind of universe that would support those kinds of research programs. We don't live in that kind of universe because I think that those theological views are just universally implausible.
There's one thing that I think is underestimated is just the effect of chance and contingency. So one of the reasons why I think science has been going on for thousands of years, it didn't start in the 17th century, but the reason that maybe the foot was put on the accelerator was because of the invention of the telescope and the microscope. This really revolutionized the way we look at it, because finally with a telescope, we could test ancient hypotheses that went against the mainstream, like Aristotle's view. And that was an accident because people, you know, the story goes, a telescope was invented because someone, you know, put two lenses together and, oh my God, I can magnify. It was pure accident, right? And then, yes, we got this big foot on the accelerator for science, but it's not like science started in the 17th century. Right. Even Newton himself said, you know, so I'm standing on the shoulders of giants.
Yeah.
Michael Strevens has pointed out that one of the big key differences that happens in early modernity is that is the realization that in order to have a good hypothesis, it has to not only be quantitative, but quantitative in a certain kind of way. That the counter examples to your hypothesis are going to come from taking ever more careful measurements. You just don't find that idea in Aristotle, right? Like, that's not how people once conceived of the scientific project. But one of the things that makes science really sort of take off is not just the invention of new instruments, but the realization that having those new instruments would be important precisely because taking ever more refined measurements was going to allow you to discriminate between hypotheses in a way that you wouldn't otherwise be able to do.
All right, so let's move on to the next clip. It's a similar sort of theme about the conflict between science and religion.
Newton, Clerk Maxwell, Charles Babbage, how it is that they were all believers in God, and yet today, people like Stephen Hawking say, you've got to either believe in God or be a scientist. Often people think that there's a conflict between God and science. Now, that cannot be the case. Think of the Nobel Prize for Physics. It was won last year by Peter Higgs, a Scotsman, the Higgs boson. And Peter Higgs is an atheist. Just a few years before that, the same Nobel Prize was won by an American, Bill Phillips, and he's a Christian. Now, they're no different as scientists. They both won the Nobel Prize, and you can get no better than that. So it can't be science versus God, obviously, because they're both brilliant scientists. What that tells us is this, that there's a real conflict, but it's not between science and God. It's between their two worldviews.
So to me, there's a conflict between science and a particular type of religion. And it's the sort of religion that takes the Bible literally. And it's the sort of religion that Lennox preaches. Bill Phillips, the guy he quotes, like he said that he condemns religious creationists who deny the clear evidence for cosmic and biological evolution, which is Lennox, right? So, yeah, I mean, of course, there's a conflict between science and God. God can be defined in so many different ways. But what do you think? What's the nature of the conflict here? Alex?
Well, I mean, a lot of it's what the sort of thing that Dan was just saying then about, like, you could use your religious textbook as a way of generating hypotheses or something, or you could take other more standard empirical methods, and you might test those two against each other and see one of them does better than the other or something. In that sense, they're competing with each other. Other than that, it's not clear what the not clear to me what the conflict is supposed to be. I mean, it seems like they're different types of thing. I mean, the idea that God exists, I mean, because he talks about like there's a conflict between science and God or something. But science is basically an epistemological method. It's just something you do to find out about the world. God is, if anything at all, an entity that it's supposed to exist, right? So one of them's like a metaphysical thing, an object or an entity or something, and the other one's an epistemological method. So of course they're not in conflict with each other. I mean, but that is kind of his point, because then he's like saying, well, it's like saying you have to choose between Henry Ford and engineering or something. But it just seems to me he's setting up such a straw man and then knocking it down and trying to sound really clever, and you know, again, in a really patronizing and annoying, slightly triggering way.
So I think part of what's going on here, there's this very old way of looking at the relationship between science and religion. It comes out of the 19th century. It's called the Draper-White hypothesis, the conflict thesis, sometimes called, or the warfare model. That was a model according to which science and religion are these two independent things. There's two distinct things, that is. But even though they're distinct, they're perpetually in conflict. And you have to then take up like one side of this or the other. Now, historically speaking, one of the places that the Draper-White model came from was that the first secular university, or maybe one of the first, I'm not completely sure if it was the first, but one of the first non-religious universities in the United States was Cornell University. And when Cornell University was founded, because it was a non-religious university and universities have been traditionally religious, there was a lot of uproar about whether or not it was proper to have a non-religious university. There were two historians, Draper and White, who came out with a book arguing that this latest, you know, then latest political upheaval reflected this ancient conflict between these two things. People have said that they can find that same warfare model in the writings of modern day thinkers like Richard Dawkins and so on. It's not entirely clear to me that that's really the same thing, but maybe it's some descendant of it. I wouldn't sign up for the warfare thesis. So the mainstream idea among historians of science about how to understand the relationship between science and religion is that the relationship is complex. There's been periods in which you couldn't really distinguish the two, but you couldn't draw like a firm boundary between the two of them. There's been other periods when people understood them as basically independent, less like the period we're living in now. There's been periods when various theological hypotheses may have been helpful to science and so on. But I think what the real argument we made from science against religion, in my view, is this kind of meta-inductive argument that I was talking about before, that when you take a step back and look at the long history of science, then you find out that that drawing hypotheses from religion is a bad way to create testable hypotheses, and that could be used in an argument against a theological perspective. That it's not going to be as simple as like lining up people and saying that there's either you're on this side or this side.
I mean, I think that the issue is Newton, Babbage, Maxwell, you know, they didn't know about evolution. So it's no good quoting those guys, because this is something that is in conflict, again, with a particular type of religious view. Again, the word religion, I just think is way too broad to have any meaning. You have to say, well, what type of religion are you talking to? And again, if it's the type of religion that Lennox advocates, then I think there clearly is a conflict. And in fact, this next clip, you know, we're going to hear about his views on Genesis. And you'll see that, you know, he's taking inspiration from the Bible about what we should find in the world. And if you can do that in Genesis, you know, you should be able to do that, you know, at the beginning, the creation of the world, you should be able to do that in the creation of humans. But I think that's sort of a lot of scientists, even if they're religious, would reject that view. But let's hear it from Lennox in this next clip.
How we can have full confidence in Scripture in general and in Genesis in particular. And of course, you can only have full confidence in something if it is true. Does it cohere? Does it make sense? And I would want to argue that Genesis makes perfect sense, but that's not enough. There's a correspondence idea. Does it correspond with reality? And therefore, there are verifications that can be done. And some of them are, of course, extremely important. The major one being, of course, that Genesis claims there was a beginning, and modern science has, after many centuries, appeared to, roughly speaking, caught up with it.
Okay, I just want to say something here, because from my background learning Hebrew, reading the Bible in Hebrew, I don't think the Bible says there was a beginning at all. Because if you read the Hebrew words, it doesn't say God. What we think of it as God creates the universe when it says heavens and earth. But the actual Hebrew words are Hashemayim, which means the sky, and we know that because the birds fly in the Hashemayim, okay? And Haaretz, God created the land, We know anyone that's brought up Jewish always sings songs about the land of Israel, Eretz Israel. So what it says is, in the beginning, God created the land and the sky. It says nothing at all about the universe. And before he does the creation, God moves over the face of the water. The water's already there. So I just don't see at all how Genesis is supposed to describe that there's a beginning to the universe. Do you think I've got that right?
Well, so in 19th century Germany, some of the best theological thought you can find from the 19th century comes out of Germany. And there they developed this idea about the history of theology called the Chaos Kampf. And the idea here was that in multiple different ancient traditions, you find this kind of primordial battle that takes place where what these theologians called chaos, that is disorder or unlawfulness, gets brushed away, and it gets replaced by the institution of order. That's precisely what you find in the Bible, where it's not that things are created ex nihilo in Genesis 1, rather it's that God acts upon the sort of disorganized waters that are already there and brings, institutes water on them, creates the sky, creates the land, establishes the days of the week, establishes what is going to happen on each of those days, establishes it's going to be a day of rest. So it's this institution of order in the world instead of this idea that things are created by God from nothing. Now, as it turns out, for a very long portion of Christian theological history, there were people who debated whether or not God had created the world from nothing. It wasn't until the 1200s when finally it was declared to be a heresy to say that the world was eternal. But prior to that, there were arguments both from Genesis and from Aristotle that that there couldn't have been a beginning of the world.
Jewish philosophers like Philo thought that the universe had always existed. There are Muslim philosophers like the Mir Sudra had this concept of recurrent creation. So it's not just in Christianity you have these.
You find this in the medieval period too, because so if you look at there's this famous correspondence, sorry, not the medieval period, the early modern period. There's this famous correspondence between Samuel Clarke and Gottfried Leibniz. And part of that correspondence has to do with when this question about when God chose to create the world. And what they're imagining in that debate, which is something very different than what we would say today, is that there was, before the creation of the world, time and space still existed. That there was just empty time stretching back infinitely far. That's Samuel Clarke's conception. And that what God had to do was to choose some instant to create the world in that midst of empty space and empty time. And so even after it was declared a heresy to say that the world was eternal, there was still a sense in which people thought the world was eternal, because, you know, it turns on this ambiguity, but what exactly the word world means. That's not really until you get to the 20th century when you get this very clear idea that the world is going to include space and time. And I think that's in part because of how those ideas enter into 20th century physical theory. But before that, even the idea of creation ex nihilo looked a bit different.
Yeah, right. The other thing that I want to point out is he's missing all the bits that Genesis gets totally wrong. This came up in a debate between Alex O'Connor and Dinesh D'Souza. And Dinesh made the same argument. Oh, look, the Bible's got the beginning of the universe in it. Amazing, which it doesn't. That's just wrong. And also, we'll come on to talk about, there's no evidence that the universe does have a beginning. But let's suppose it does and it got it right. What about all the stuff it got wrong? Now, Alex O'Connor brought up the issue of the sequence that the sun is created on day four. Alex didn't mention the fact that the plants were already in existence, right? He should have pointed that out. But the thing that to me is the biggest, most obvious mistake is that there's a solid dome of the sky, the firmament. And the reason I think that's so important is because other bits you could say, well, they're just telling a story, they didn't really believe it. But the idea of a solid dome of the sky was very widely believed in the ancient world. Mm-hmm. And the fact that the Bible has it is a very obvious mistake. Why doesn't he mention that?
So another thing to be pointed out here is that insofar as the Bible talks about the creation of the universe or of the world, however you understand that, whether it's creation ex nihilo or not, it's certainly not unique in that respect, right? Mm-hmm. So if my friend Bessie Jelinek were here, what she would point out to us is that one of her favorite books, the Timaeus, this book by Plato, has an account in it of the creation of the world. You could take up the view that, oh, this other ancient text is the one that we should look for our religious beliefs, and not the Bible, because the Timaeus gets it right. And by the way, the Timaeus gets other things right, that there's going to be this institution of like mathematical order in the world that you didn't see any representation of in Genesis.
Well, I also just want to point out that there's only two options, right? Either the universe had a beginning or it didn't. So it's out of all the range of things they could have got right, they picked one of two options, you know? Like, it's literally 50-50. I mean, it's not a remarkable. It's not like I think of a natural number and I guess it correctly or something, like, where it's infinite, where it's 50-50. It's the least impressive, like, prediction, even if it was one, right?
Which it isn't.
Is that a prediction of the...
Yeah, which it isn't. But even if it was, it would be the least impressive one
Hang on. Just before I forget, there are other creation stories that are much more clear, like in the beginning, like God created the universe from nothing. The Kiowa Apache creation myth is very clear. Like in the beginning, it was just empty space, nothingness, right? Mm. Also, there's a hymn from one of the sutras says the same thing, you know. So they're much more clear that there was creation ex nihilo, which is absolutely not clear in the Bible at all.
Yeah.
All right.
The other thing I was just going to say very briefly is that it would have been much more impressive if it had like given a prediction for the CM or the temperature of the CMB or something, right? Like that would have been that would have impressed me. But sometimes people say that it mentions the Big Bang because it talks about, I don't think this is in Genesis, but it's elsewhere, that God stretches out the heavens like you would stretch out a tent. And it's like, actually, I think it's more that they thought that the sky was like a big tent. Like, that's what I think that's saying.
Exactly. Yeah. And in fact, it says that the world is a disc. There's a Hebrew word for disc and a Hebrew word for ball. And they could have used the word for ball, but they didn't. They used the word for dick.
Right.
So there's just so much that they got wrong. I would be impressed if they said the universe was in a very hot, dense state and then started to expand 13.8 billion years ago. Oh, and I've heard lots of people say, well, there's no Hebrew word for 13.8 billion years. Nonsense. You could easily say that in Hebrew. You could say there were containers. They could say, well, the number of years was the number of things that you would put in this container. I've actually written it out in Hebrew, and it's easily done. Anyway, shall we move on to the next clip?
One more little point before, whilst we're putting the boot into this bit as well, is because he does say it needs to be both corresponds to reality, basically the things that he says are true, but he says, for some reason, he says, in addition to that, it also has to be coherent, right? And then he's just like, and it definitely is completely coherent, and then just keeps going as if that's like enough. It's like, but it's quite crazy, isn't it? I mean, like, it's not a normal, just factual state of affairs. It's like talking snakes and like, you know, if you eat an apple, everybody's doomed for the rest of time. So it's weird. It's super weird. It's not like, how can you just say, oh, yeah, that's perfectly consistent? All he means is I've brought myself around to accepting all of those things. So now I don't question any of them. That's all. It's just an autobiographical statement about his attitude.
Plato's Timaeus, as far as I'm aware, doesn't contain any contradictions either.
Right, let's move on to the next clip. And I think this is kind of really ironic because Lennox has been saying no conflict between science and religion, and then he goes all on attack on evolution.
Even Dawkins, I believe, has totally given up the idea that evolution, in his view, is purely by chance. Because if you concentrate on the first part of your question, monkeys given unlimited time and all this kind of thing, it's very easy to calculate that that's just absurd. Fred Hoyle, again, a brilliant mathematician, says that the reason
that troops of monkeys thundering away at random and typewriters couldn't produce the works of Shakespeare because the whole observable universe is not big enough to contain the necessary hordes of monkeys. And he says, similarly, the likelihood of the spontaneous formation of life from inanimate matters is one to a number with 40,000 noughts after it. And he adds, and I must quote this, it's lovely, it's big enough to bury Darwin and the whole theory of evolution. There was no primeval soup. This is Fred Hoyle. And if the beginnings of life were not random, they must therefore have been the product of purposeful intelligence. He had the idea that the monkeys are typing, but there's a head monkey watching them. And when they get a correct letter, like the first M, the head monkey presses a switch and that thing is held. And of course, you then get the whole phrase quite rapidly. And he said, there you are, that's how it's done. But it's laughable, actually, as many people have pointed out, that the very thing Dawkins hates, that is intelligent input, is precisely what's built into his machine right from the very beginning.
Now, I should add that this bit that he's talking about is Dawkins' book, The Blind Watchmaker. And in this book, there's a bit where he said, could we get a passage from Hamlet? He thinks it's like a weasel, I think it's the passage. And he said, well, and Dawkins says, you know, if it was random chance, we're not going to see this. But if there's some kind of selection effect, then everything's different. So it seems to me what's laughable is John Lennox's understanding of what he's read. Yes,
exactly. Yeah. It's obviously an analogy to say there's a head monkey who says, okay, you've got the first letter correct. It's obviously an analogy. That's not Dawkins' actual theory, of course, of monkeys. What? Like, that's not his theory. And then he's like saying, so therefore intentionality is built in. No, not at all. Exactly the opposite.
Sorry. I think it's really important that the way that evolution works is that you have randomized variation, but that randomized variation is subject to non-random selection. And so one way that you could have non-random selection is if it were an intelligent agent. We do that all the time. This is how dog breeds come about. But Darwin, when he was writing on the Origin of Species, when he was developing evolutionary thought, he knew about animal husbandry. In fact, he talked to animal breeders and bred his own animals. If you watch the movie Creation, it shows some breeding pigeons and so on. Darwin's idea was that you could have non-random selection without an intelligent agent. And the way that that works is that there are certain kinds of features that are most likely to stick around because when animals have those features, those traits, they are more likely than they would otherwise be to have offspring. And so in future generations, we will see many more of those traits. And so it's, you know, that just is the picture, right? Is that you have randomized variation subject to non-random selection. Now, the other thing that's sort of bizarre about this, you know, people have been doing these kinds of calculations for a long time that sometimes it's creationists that do these calculations, sometimes it's non-creationists like Fred Hoyle. There's this famous example where you imagine a tornado coming through a junkyard and assembling a 747. And what are the odds of that happening? Mm-hmm. That's supposed to be somehow analogous to what it would be like if you had a molecule assembling itself out of a primordial soup. The problem is that that's just not an accurate representation of how many chemical systems work. So as an example of a chemical system that works very differently, let's talk about proteins. Proteins are these big, bendy molecules that can change shape in three-dimensional space, and they have a lot of parts. Each of those parts is an amino acid, so a protein might, for example, be composed of 100 amino acids. Now, proteins' function depends on its ability to fold into the correct three-dimensional shape. And so in order for it to be in the right state for an organism, it needs to fold up on itself in a particular sort of way. Now, each of the amino acids can be in, say, 10 different states. So if you have a protein that's 100 amino acids long, then the number of different states that it could be in would be 10 to the 100. So if a protein had to randomly sample all of its states, it would take something like 10 to the 81 years to find the correct shape. That's a great example that comes from Rolf Blossi's Computational Biology on page 62, if someone wants to look that up. However, if you place a protein...
Do a citation.
That's right.
Very soon, in apologetics and counter-apologetics.
If you place a protein in water, and with the right concentration of magnesium ions, that's actually really important that it has the right magnesium ion concentration, then it will fold into a correct shape almost immediately. And by the way, something that be pointed out here is that regardless of what its environment is, that is, regardless of whether there's the right concentration of magnesium ions or not, it will fold into some particular shape that would take something like 10 to 81 years if it were searching randomly. It just so happens that if you have the kind of concentration of magnesium ions you find inside of cells, then the protein tends to fold up into the right shape. How does that happen? How does a protein that has so many, this vastly huge number of possible states, almost immediately find the correct shape? Well, so when you flip a regular coin, it lands on either side basically 50% of the time. But if you have a trick coin that's heavier on one side than it is on the other, it will land on one side more often, right? Land on the heavier side facing down more often. So if you have a string, say, of 100 heads, that would ordinarily be considered improbable. However, a string of 100 heads of a biased coin wouldn't at all be improbable. In fact, it would be precisely what you would expect. It might be the most probable thing in the world. Proteins are something like trick coins. They fold in specific shapes because of the forces acting on them, because of geometric and topological constraints that they might be subject to, and so on. They naturally minimize free energy to achieve what we might call the correct shape without any kind of intelligent design acting on them. So protein folding is nothing at all like monkeys typing at keyboards, and the same is true for many other biochemical processes. And we don't know yet the processes that led to the first living thing. We know various pieces of that story. But what we shouldn't expect is that story will involve some kind of process where every state in some vastly huge number of states has to be looked through. Instead, we should expect that it's some process wherein there are specific states that are much more likely, that they're much more likely because of the particular forces and other kinds of constraints and so on that the system might be subject to. So Lennox's argument is silly here because no one should think that biological systems or proto-biological systems, whatever, work like monkeys typing at keyboards.
Right. And certainly Dawkins didn't suggest anything. He's like, oh, Dawkins will give up the idea that it's all random. Like, that's the basics of everything. The very basics, like what you'd learn at school, is that evolution is not just random, right? I mean, it is just mind-blowing that he says stuff like this. But moreover, he's talking about origins of life, burying Darwin. Darwin's theory is not about the origins of life. It's got nothing to do with the origins of life. So even if you think there's a miracle needed for the origins of life, doesn't affect Darwin at all. I mean, it's the levels of misunderstanding are just...
That's a really important point that maybe I should have brought up before, is that so in addition to the calculation being silly for the reasons that I described, you don't have the same mechanism with regards to the origin of life as you have for these later processes, right? So later processes, or where you have randomized variation subject to non-random selection, it may be that there's some kind of like proto-biological systems that were also subject to randomized variation with selection, or it might not be. It could be that you have some kind of early process that doesn't work that way, which would be one of the reasons why, you couldn't say, oh, we've solved this problem for these other systems and then apply it to the origin of life. That's why, with respect to the origin of life, you have to look at like, how should we expect chemical kinetics to work generally? Is it like monkeys typing at keyboards? And it turns out that it's not. That's just not the way that systems work.
All right, so let's go from the origin of life to the origin of the universe. There's going to be a slightly longer clip, but there's just so much he gets wrong that I think it's worth playing.
And so we have to face the fact that there's a singularity. And the most recent results of Bohr, Vilenkin, and Guth are the world authorities of this, mathematicians and theoretical astronomers. It is said that an argument is what convinces reasonable men. and a proof is what it takes to convince even an unreasonable man. With the proof now in place, cosmologists can no longer hide behind the possibility of a past eternal universe. There is no escape. They have to face the problem of a cosmic beginning. So they have to get a universe from nothing. Now you see, as a Christian, I don't have a problem with this, because the universe came from nothing physical, but it didn't come from nothing. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth, and God is spirit. He's not physical, but he's not nothing. But let's get rid of God now. And the wonder of modern science is we are now forced into a corner because we've got to get God from nothing. Listen to Hawking's attempt to do that. This is his book, The Grand Design. This is his central statement. Because there is a law of gravity, the universe can and will create itself from nothing. Flat contradiction number one. But it's worse than that. The idea that laws can create something. That's absurd, ladies and gentlemen. And I was debating with Alan Guth, who's one of the leading cosmologists in the world, who is the author of The Theory of Inflation. So having the opportunity, I thought I'd ask him in public about this. I said, look, Alan, there's a lot of confusion out there about the meaning of nothing, and I'd like to clear it up with you. You do not mean, as a physicist, nothing in the sense of the absence of anything. You mean something that you sometimes call a quantum vacuum or a Higgs field or something like this, and it is not nothing. No, he said, it is absolutely not the case. It is not nothing.
Okay, so I want to tell an anecdote of my interaction with Lennox here, because I met him at a conference in London, and he said, oh, Guth is saying the universe had a beginning. And I went, he doesn't. Guth thinks the universe is eternal into the past. And rather than, and he said this to like a room full of hundreds of people. And I said, I think you should correct that because that's wrong. And he said, you know what, I'll tell you what, we'll cut it from the DVD, the incorrect statement, rather than actually post a correction to a false statement. And that seems to be extremely disingenuous. And also the thing from Alan Guth, you know, oh, you know, it's not, vacuum's not nothing. I mean, he's completely misquoting it. Guth wrote, and I'll give a citation here, well, I don't know the page number, I'm afraid, but it's towards the back of the book. But Alan Guth, in his book, The Inflationary Universe, talks about the idea of a universe from nothing. And he says, well, there's like two sort of versions of this. There's Edward Tryon's version, which is a universe from a vacuum fluctuation, right? So that is not nothing, right? And but then there's this Vilenkin version where the idea is that the volume of the universe starts off as zero. So there's no space and time there. There's no quantum vacuum. So this is the quote from Alan Guth. He said, in the context, the proposal that the universe was created from empty space seems no more fundamental than the proposal that the universe was spawned by a piece of rubber. It might be true, but one would still want to ask where the piece of rubber came from. In 1982, Alex Vilenkin of Tufts University proposed an extension to Tryon's idea. He suggested the universe was created by a quantum process starting from literally nothing. And Guth actually italicized this, right? Meaning not only the absence of matter, but the absence of space and time as well. So that's the end of the quote. So Guth, like the idea that Guth would have said that to him just doesn't seem remotely plausible. The other thing that I'd point out is that he's got this quote from Vilenkin, and he says it's from Bordar Guth Vilenkin saying that, you know, who are the world's top experts in theoretical astronomy. I mean, he doesn't even know the name of the profession. It's called cosmology, right? But, you know, Guth doesn't think that the universe had a beginning. And Vilenkin said that in a popular paperback book. That's not in anywhere in the paper. And when I interviewed Vilenkin, he actually kind of recanted and said, no, this theorem only says that inflation had a beginning. Doesn't say that the universe had a beginning. And the other thing I'd want to point out is that, two more things, and then I'll pass on to you guys. One, if there was a beginning to the universe, it doesn't follow that there was a creation ex nihilo. It could just be that, you know, there's a big time just stops ticking. That doesn't follow that it's from nothing. And the last part is that he said, oh, laws can't create anything. That's absurd, ladies and gentlemen. But what kind of argument is that? Just saying it's absurd. Yeah. Guth has made a very explicit argument. I'll give another quote. And he said this, this is from Discovery Magazine interview. And he said, no, I think laws can create things. He says, if you bang two electrons together with enough energy, you produce protons. If there are no independent laws, then all the properties of protons must somehow be known by the electrons. By extension, every elementary particle must carry around enough information to produce the entire universe. I find this difficult to believe. And he added that if laws are just properties of objects, how can those laws continue to operate when the object is not really there? So he's making an argument that, and Valenkin makes a similar argument, that the laws actually have some sort of independent status. So I don't see any, if it's okay for God to create the universe from nothing, why not the laws creating the universe from nothing? And the advantage is we know the laws exist in some sense. Now, in what sense you can debate, right? Are they just descriptions or do they have something more forceful? But at least we know they exist in some sense. So I just think this whole comment is just wrong on so many levels.
Yeah. Let me just come in before Dan says much more comprehensive stuff than I'm going to say. But just following on from what you're saying there, it's like the contrast. I mean, maybe it's a bit weird to think that laws have causal powers or something. Okay. But the paucity of detail in the alternative explanation is just like striking, right? He's saying, well, because I'm quite fine with it. It's not creation ex nihilo because, you know, God does it. What do you mean God does it? What are you talking about? How does that work? What's the detail? There is no detail, right? And it is creation from nothing in the sense that it's ex materio, right? There's no pre-existing material out of which the universe was made. That's already enough to be completely perplexing because that's the thing we don't see happening all the time, right? So somehow a disembodied supermind thinks material into existence. The hell is that as a type of explanation? I mean, you may as well say that laws do it, right? They're both just equally perplexing. It's so bonkers that he thinks one of them is slam dunk, dead easy, no question, and the other one is just absurd, right? Yeah, anyway. Dan, go on. Tell us. Actually, one thing, can I just ask you, why, what's the quote that he read out is super misleading if... the goof quote at the beginning about like there's nowhere to hide.
It's Valenkin.
Yeah, right. There's nowhere to hide. They have to accept that there's a beginning or whatever. It's super misleading, confusing to a lot of people. Like for instance, me, because I'm not skilled enough to read the detail of the physics. But like the way he's describing it does make it seem like there should be a beginning, right? If all he means is that the inflation period has to be finite towards the past. That just sounds like a very misleading way of saying that. So how do we reconcile those two things?
I think that it was in a paperback book. And when you write a paperback book, you know, you go for hyperbole. Hawking does the same, right? And it's nowhere in the paper. And when I was in Valenkin's office and I asked him about this, he didn't say anything like that.
Right.
He just said, no, it just proves inflation had a beginning. So I think he was writing a paperback book. And of course, the publisher pushes you to, you know, get some hyperbolic statements out there. He might have believed that at the time, I don't know. But all I can say is, it doesn't really matter what he believed when he wrote this paperback book. What matters is what's in the scientific literature, what other people have said, and you know, no one thinks that this thing proves that, you know, as far as I know. I mean, maybe there are a few people, but, I think
one thing that, and I don't know if this is what Valenkin was really going after, because he has... push for the idea that the universe is some sort of ex nihilo origin elsewhere. But the one thing that's worth keeping in mind when reading popularizations of cosmology or statements made by physicists or cosmologists or whatever is that the word universe has multiple meanings. It's polysemous. And one way to see that, a very quick way to see that, is to look back at the history of early 20th century cosmology. So when people finally realized that there were other galaxies, they'd seen these blobs in telescopes that they called spiral nebulae. They eventually realized these were other galaxies. And when they realized there were other galaxies, they began to refer to each galaxy as an island universe.
Right.
Now, today, we don't use the word universe. Is it? Okay. Yeah, I know Kant had... he was one of the very... few people prior to the 20th century that had considered the idea that the Milky Way was a galaxy and so on. In any case, there's this whole debate that happens in early 20th century cosmology about the island universe and about whether there are multiple universes or one, by which they meant multiple galaxies or one. And, you know, there's something similar with, for instance, the word world. We talked about the eternity of the world earlier. We're not talking about the eternity of the Earth, right? But sometimes people use the word world, they just mean the planet Earth. And so both of these words are to have multiple meanings. And one of the things that's really important is that in physics, the term universe has come to mean just the largest portion of physical reality that we are able to observe. And then other universes would be other regions like that one that are beyond, they're further away than what we're able to see through telescopes and so on. And so, you know, it could be that this region has a beginning, even though it doesn't mean at all the physical reality has a beginning. I think that that's an important part about to start off on the BVG theorem. You know, that theorem, as we've said numerous times, just tells you that if you have an inflating really what it says is if you have an exponentially expanding region of space-time, then that region could not have been expanding forever. It needs to have begun its expansion at some point in the past. Now, that's assuming the theorem is true. There's been some recent literature that I haven't done a great job familiarizing myself with that apparently shows that there are counterexamples to the BVG theorem. I know that Phil has an entire video on that literature. So it could be the BVG theorem.
You can see it. And we interview some of the scientists who are involved in that work.
So if that's right, then that means that the BVG theorem is not even a theorem. It doesn't even tell you that an expanding region of space-time couldn't have been expanding forever. But if it is a theorem, it's only a theorem about classical space-times. Now, in all likelihood, we don't live in a classical space-time. Mm-hmm. That's because we have fairly good reasons internal both to our current best theory of particle physics, as a standard model of particle physics, and our current best theory of gravity, that's general relativity, for thinking that both of those theories will be surpassed in the future by some new theory that's able to incorporate both of those. And what that means is that our understanding of space-time will be replaced by something else, something we don't have yet, or might not have yet. I mean, there are proposals for what this theory might be. It could be that it's one of those proposals, or it might be that it's some theory we haven't thought of yet. But since the VGG theorem probably doesn't, in fact, apply to the space-time we really live in, because it only applies to classical space-times, in that case, in some sense, who cares? Moreover, even if we do live in a classical space-time, there's another set of results, specifically about classical space-times, the Melnick-Manchak theorems, which show that, in all likelihood, we couldn't ever know enough about the overall structure, the global structure of our space-time, to know that our space-time overall had a beginning. So in other words, we couldn't know enough to know that the BVG theorem or any other singularity theorem that we have or are ever likely to have applies to all of space-time. It seems like it doesn't really tell you much of importance for this debate about whether the universe had an origin from nothing. Now, could the universe have come from nothing? Well, I said that there are these multiple proposals for quantum gravity theories, right? Theories that go beyond the standard model particle physics and beyond general relativity. And many of those theories, time is not fundamental to the universe. Our understanding of time comes from general relativity to a large extent. The theory that goes beyond general relativity, it may be that time itself is somehow something that results in a less fundamental picture of the world. If time is not fundamental to the universe, then the universe is not fundamentally temporal. And anything that's not temporal doesn't have a beginning. And so in that case, it would turn out that the universe does not have a beginning. But of course, even if time is not fundamental, it could be that in some non-fundamental description, time is finite to the past. And so in that non-fundamental sense, the universe could have a beginning. And it could be a beginning such that there was nothing at all that preceded it. And so in that sense, it would have a non-fundamental beginning from nothing. But that, I don't think, is anything that should worry any naturalist, right? It just means that in this description, that's not the deepest description that you could give. It turns out that you can't turn the clock back more than a certain extent. Now, could laws create something from nothing or create anything at all? Well, there's no agreed upon view about what laws are, as we've already said, but there are multiple views on which laws constrain what can happen. If it turns out that one of those kinds of views is right, that what the laws do is that they constrain what can happen, they constrain the space of possible things that can happen, then it might be that in some metaphysically thick sense, the laws constrain everything that can happen. And so then it could be that of all the ways that there could be, in all of them, the universe has a finite past. Well, in that case, there's a sense in which the universe must have a finite past because the laws are what they are. Now, you know, you could object that that doesn't mean that the laws cause the universe to exist. Maybe laws can't cause anything. Maybe they don't have any causal efficacy. But again, I don't see why that should really matter. If it's true that there's this fundamental constraint on over all the possible ways that things could be, such that out of all those possible ways, the universe must have a finite past, well, then the laws would explain how the universe came from nothing, even if the laws didn't create the universe from nothing.
All right, so we're going to move on to the problem of evil now, the last topic. But does Linux even get what the problem is right? Let's find out.
The hardest problem I face as a Christian is the problem of evil and pain. My niece getting a tumor at 22 that kills her. What do I say to my sister? And this is the hardest problem we face. But it seems to me that atheism here has no answer, because by definition, atheism believes that human death is the end, so there is no ultimate hope. God has not remained distant from our human suffering, but has become part of it. The vast majority of people in the history of the world have died without justice and will die without justice. And if death is the end, then of course they have no hope of ultimate justice. But the promise in the New Testament, guaranteed by the resurrection of Jesus, is that he is to be the judge in the coming day.
Alex.
Oh, okay. So many things, there's so many things wrong going on at the same time. We were having this conversation before we started recording, and I suppose in some sense you could be super generous, but the traditional thing in the philosophy of religion, it's called the problem of evil, is basically just supposed to be that, like, if God is good, like, what does it mean to say that God is good, right? Part of what it means is that God tries to eliminate evils if he can, because straightforwardly, if you see, you know, someone being beaten up or whatever, and you could break up the fight, but you just go, it doesn't matter, and walk on, you're doing something morally culpable in virtue of just not intervening. And a good person would try and say, no, don't fight, let's all be friends or something. And it's this very intuitive idea that, like, goodness means trying to prevent unnecessary stuff that you could prevent. So the sort of traditional version of the problem of evil is just that God's all-powerful, so he could intervene all the time. He's all-knowing, so it's never that he doesn't know about some evil that's happening. And he's all good, so he should want to eliminate evil wherever it's found. And so the idea is supposed to be that there couldn't be any evil at all on if theism is true. So just the simple presence of any evil whatsoever is, you know, in this very strong version of the argument, is logically incompatible with God's existence. And that's the problem of evil, it's the traditional problem. There shouldn't be any if God exists. And then you can make slightly sort of weaker versions of that, where it's like, it's unlikely if God exists, but maybe there's, you know, there could be some, but there shouldn't be loads. And we do see, like, unnecessary, gratuitous suffering all over the place, and that makes the God hypothesis less likely, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, there's loads of different ways you can formulate this, but that's the basic idea, some fundamental incompatibility between God and suffering. But Lennox doesn't, I don't know if he doesn't know that. I mean, presumably he has at some point read something about this, you'd like to think, but he just doesn't talk about that problem at all and talks about a completely different problem, which is, what are you supposed to say to someone if they're suffering? Which is what I just described a minute ago, is I outlined like a couple of different versions of arguments where the conclusion is that God doesn't exist, or God probably doesn't exist. But here it's just like, well, what do you mean? If you personally don't know what to say to someone when they're sad, so what? Nothing follows from that. That's not an argument, right? Even if there was nothing you could say, so what? I mean, unless there's some part of the God hypothesis, which is that it's part of the God hypothesis that you would have something to say if someone hurt themselves or whatever. But that's obviously absent. So it's just nothing. There's no argument here whatsoever. But I mean, and then he says, well, the atheist doesn't have anything to say, because if you're suffering, the atheist can't make you feel better about it. That doesn't seem true either. I mean, say you've got a terminal illness and you're about to die, and an atheist can't tell you that they know you're going to go to heaven, I guess, but they can tell you soon all of this will be over, that, you know, if they assume, the atheist thinks that there's no afterlife or anything, you know, soon it'll be like you've gone to a peaceful deep sleep. But I don't see why that's not a consolation. You could say that to someone. You could also lie to them. You could just say, well, it's going to be great in the afterlife. You could still say anything. But it's really no constraint just because you're an atheist. You can console people, right? You know, that is a thing. And then he also then goes on to say, well, if atheism is true, there's no justice, right? Which is a different thing. It's not really about suffering as such. I mean, if I've got a disease or something, there's not really any justice. But justice isn't really the active concept. I mean, justice would only be the sort of thing we'd be looking at if it was that you were wronged by another person, right? So say your child gets murdered by somebody. Well, justice demands some kind of punishment to that person for the wrongdoing that they did. That's what justice means, basically. The person getting what they're owed, what they're due. So, okay, on the atheist model, the idea is that, you know, someone could murder someone and then get away with it. You know, maybe they don't get sent to prison, but also when they die, they're not getting burnt in hell or something. And that's the absence of retribution that's supposed to be going on. And Lennox is trying to highlight that on the atheist model, everyone just, you know, ends up in the same place, whether they're good or bad, right? And so in that sense, there's no justice because we don't balance the books at the end of time. There's no ledger that like tallies up everything and makes sure everyone gets what they're owed. Okay, but let's not forget that we do have to look at the alternative hypothesis to see, is it like, on his view, is it actually like a cleaner solution or something? It seems to me the big glaring problem with specifically Christianity is that, I mean, there is in a sense some idea of retribution and balancing the ledger at the end of time or something. Problem is, it's just done in the wrong way, right? It's not actually addressing, because on Christianity, you could be a child murdering pedophile or whatever, convert on your deathbed and go to heaven alongside the children that you murdered and were a pedophile towards or whatever. And that just seems to me it's not justice. I don't know what the concept is there. It might be some schmustice or something. But it's obviously not giving everyone what they're due. It's wiping the ledger clear. It's a mercy over justice, right? Because so sometimes a judge could say, the strict application of the law here demands you should go to prison for 10 years or something. But in this case, I'm going to be merciful and just send you to prison for 5 years or whatever. And what's going on there is that his inaction of mercy is maybe somehow virtuous, even though it's not just, right? So sometimes mercy and justice pull in different directions, and you can be merciful because you're not being just, or sticking to the letter of the law means that you can't then be merciful, right? They kind of pull in different directions. But clearly what's going on in the Christian story is that God's merciful to those people who believe in him and ask for forgiveness. He then wipes their slate clean. But that's just to say it's not justice. Justice is not being enacted because mercy is being enacted instead. And those two things pull differently. So you can't say, justice on the Christian picture is just a totally straightforward concept and it's everybody's understanding. No, it's explicitly not justice when the definitive Christian thing, which is that you believe the right things and then get forgiven, that's obviously not justice. So, yeah, maybe there's no justice on the atheist picture in a sense, but it's a big, big problem, it seems to me, for Christianity. And he's, I don't know, doesn't know about that or something, like all of these other concepts. But yeah, basically, he's not talking about the problem of evil. He's talking about the problem of cosmic justice. And he doesn't, like with all of this stuff, he presents the weakest, most kind of flaccid version of the opponent's views and then tries to knock them down without saying. And he basically just says, yeah, well, you know, on this side of things, God just somehow does it, or God just somehow makes it just. And that's fine. Let's not question that. So yet again, very annoying, triggering kind of response there.
So one of the things that is just very simple that I think he starts off the right at the beginning of the clip, he says that the by definition, atheists don't believe in an afterlife. Well, maybe it's a fact about many atheists that they don't believe in an afterlife, but that's not by definition. Atheism is the view that there are no gods, but there could be, it could be that there are no gods even though there's an afterlife. The other thing to be said here is that, you know, there's another thing we were saying before the recording. There's two different, there's this distinction people draw in the literature, but two different versions of the problem of evil. One of them is the philosophical problem, and that's the one that we're all familiar with from philosophy, but whether or not suffering is some sort of evidence against God's existence. And the other is the pastoral problem. He seems to be conflating the two. The pastoral problem, something like, what should a pastor say to someone that's suffering? Now, I don't understand how he's even solved the pastoral problem, because he says, oh, God came down to earth, and, you know, because God incarnated as Jesus, God suffers alongside us. How is that supposed to make me feel better? Like, you know, suppose that, here's one scenario. Suppose that Alex kidnaps me, ties me up in his basement, and is torturing me. We'd all recognize that then this is very good evidence that Alex is not a perfectly good being. Well, suppose instead what Alex does is that Alex kidnaps me, ties me up in his basement, and then pays Phil to come over and, like, tie up both of us. Now both Alex and I are tied up in the basement, but now Alex is paying Phil to torture both of us. So now Alex is suffering alongside me. Well, that doesn't make me have any better feelings about Alex. I'm still going to think that that what's going on is just as horrible, and that Alex is treated me just as unfairly, and that it doesn't do anything to alleviate the experience or to exonerate Alex if that's what happens. So, you know, I've heard other apologists say this too, that there's no problem of evil on Christianity because God suffers alongside us. Well, that's not a solution to any problem, whether the philosophical problem or the pastoral problem.
I think the analogy I would think of is, imagine you go to the doctor and says, good news and bad news. The bad news is you've got cancer. The good news is I've also got cancer. Like, I'm going to suffer with you, so everything's fine. No!
Yeah, it's bonkers. And I think it's also just like the idea, I mean, there's supposed to be this like balancing of the ledger kind of thing, but there's something like, you know, imagine you're the person who's like a 3-year-old in Nazi Germany, you get chucked in a concentration camp and you're horribly abused and then you die or whatever. You have this like tiny little life and it's filled with like suffering and all of that stuff. And then you go to heaven. And okay, now it's like super chill and you got all of whatever, it's really great in heaven or something. But it seems to me that you could still feel like resentment for the fact that like you had to go through that earlier stage. And then even if God says, oh yeah, but I've got this big plan according to which it has to play out exactly like this in order for some reason that nobody can understand. It just seems to me that still I want to say, well, why was it me that was like that person rather than, you know, these like, I don't know, Rupert Murdoch or something, who's like still alive and kicking, and even though he's like a hideous kind of blight on society or whatever, he gets to just hang about on Earth for ages, being a billionaire and chilling, presumably going to get to heaven as well if he says the right things just before he dies. But just this person,
fifth wife, I think.
Right, exactly. So it's still fundamentally unfair, and it doesn't really help to say, well, now I've made good because now you're in heaven, and also I have a plan that meant that you have to suffer. I'd still be furious about that. Like, that's still not just at all. That's like a kind of metaphysical abomination that you'd set up this big story to pan out like this, and some people like me are collateral damage and they just have to take the hit, like take one for the team or something. It's so unfair. Anyway, so just all of that stuff. Lennox doesn't seem remotely interested in presenting a reasonable version of what atheists actually think. It's constantly straw mannings, constantly just picking stupid examples of cliche people. It's Dawkins is the only person who's ever said anything interesting about atheism according to Lennox. It's tedious, really. It really is annoying. So I think we should do some actual philosophy next.
We will. Yeah, I think next episode we'll do philosophy. And maybe we'll go back to some comedy stuff.
Yeah.
All right. Well, thank you so much for watching, everyone. If you like this, please like and subscribe. If you've got any suggestions, please leave them in the comments. And any thoughts about this content, please leave them in the comments. And we'll see you next time on The Sci-Fi Show.